we are undertaking activities, including submitting this plan, in order to preserve the option of the 2015 season.
Shell files a plan to return to the Arctic. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 28th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, new genetic analysis rewrites the history of the earliest native people of Arctic Alaska and Canada.
Either they were pushed out into the fringes of the Arctic area where they couldn't survive economically, or else they may simply have been annihilated.
That's tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you've served in the military, the Alaska VA welcomes you home and thanks you for your service. You may be eligible for VA health care benefits, including reimbursement for your care at 26 tribal health care facilities and their 180-plus outlying clinics manned by providers and community health aides throughout the state of Alaska. Apply online at 1010ez.med.va.gov. Call 257-3323 for questions. This message sponsored by the VA.
Shell Oil took its first step toward returning to the Arctic this morning. The company filed a new plan to explore the Chukchi Sea with federal regulators in Anchorage. But as KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, that filing is far from a commitment.
Shell's had the last 2 years to consider what approach it might take if it returned to explore in the Arctic. Spokesperson Megan Baldino says that's apparent in the plans that the company submitted to the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management on Thursday.
If we decide to explore in 2015, we will have both rigs drilling in the Chukchi Sea.
Instead of keeping one rig in Dutch Harbor as a backup, both vessels would be sent north to drill.
So they would act as each other's backup rig in the unlikely event that it would be needed.
The rigs would also be taking advantage of the short ice-free summer, which they'd need to make progress on the 6 wells that Shell wants to complete within the next few years. But Baldino says that's not set in stone because the company isn't sure it will return next summer.
It's really important to point out that we have not made a formal decision, but we are undertaking activities, including submitting this plan, in order to preserve the option of the 2015 season.
Shell tried to mount an expedition to the Arctic this summer, but they canceled those plans after a federal court ruling cast major doubt on the legality of Shell's leases in the Chukchi Sea. That question still hasn't been resolved, says John Callahan. He's a public affairs officer for the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. Callahan says that regulators have to finish a new environmental impact statement for the Chukchi lease sale.
Assuming that our supplemental EIS is accepted, then the Secretary of Interior will make a decision in March of 2015 as to whether to uphold the sale and proceed or cancel the sale.
Until that happens, Callahan says BOEM can only conduct an informal review of Shell's new exploration plan.
We'll call Shell and have meetings and say, hey, we need more information on X, or it doesn't look like Section Y is complete, that kind of thing.
Those lines of communication won't extend to the public. BOEM will not post Shell's exploration plans to its website or take public comments on them until the leases are on solid ground. But that's not stopping some environmental groups from weighing in. On Thursday afternoon, Oceana Vice President Susan Murray issued a statement saying Shell's, quote, no more prepared to conduct offshore oil and gas exploration activity in Alaska's remote Arctic Ocean than it was in 2012, end quote. Until Shell and other oil companies can prove they're ready, Murray says the federal government should put Arctic exploration on hold. And on Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Governor Sean Parnell has vetoed a bill that would have scrubbed CourtView, that's the state's online criminal records database, of any charge that did not result in a conviction. In a letter to lawmakers, Parnell described Senate Bill 108 as legislation that, quote, summarily sweeps all cases that do not end in a guilty verdict, again, quote, under the cloak of confidentiality, in an unnecessarily broad manner without respect to likely adverse impacts on the public. During testimony on the bill, the case of serial killer Israel Keyes, who committed suicide before going to trial, was frequently cited as an instance where court records would have been sealed under the law. The bill was opposed by the Office of Victims' Rights and by the Alaska Press Club. The bill was introduced by Republican Fred Dyson, a retiring state senator from Eagle River. Dyson viewed the legislation as a matter of justice and of privacy, arguing that people who are not found guilty in court should not have their records listed in a public database. In place of Senate Bill 108, the Alaska court system has adopted a rule that would wipe the records of any person who was arrested but not charged with a crime. This is the second bill this cycle that Parnell has vetoed. The Alaska Conference of Mayors has come out against a ballot initiative that would regulate marijuana like alcohol. The coalition passed a resolution opposing Proposition 2 out of concerns over cost and safety, and it also donated $5,000 to the political action group Big Marijuana. Big mistake. The Conference of Mayors represents nearly 100 Alaska communities but excluded some of the state's larger municipalities such as Anchorage and Juneau. A spokesperson for the initiative called the decision, quote, unfortunate, given that alcohol is already sold in many of those communities. Last night, the conservative umbrella group United for Liberty hosted the first Senate debate of the general election season. Democratic incumbent Mark Begich and Republican challenger Dan Sullivan squared off in an Anchorage auditorium and used the event to establish some of the themes of their campaigns. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports Begich described his approach to politics as pragmatic, and Sullivan presented himself as a political outsider who wants to take on Washington.
The prelude music played before the debate was a Bach cantata commonly played at weddings. It was the most harmonious moment in a night where the two candidates disagreed on nearly everything save the spelling of the Alaska state bird. The questions began conventionally enough. The candidates were asked about fisheries management, and Democratic incumbent Mark Begich used the question to cast himself as a practical lawmaker focused on Alaska-specific policies.
I chair the committee that deals with the fisheries and Coast Guard. We are now looking at electronic monitoring, more observers that need to be funded properly. We need to ensure the new technologies and innovation that is available to go after bycatch, and we just passed four treaties to go after these people who I consider pirates.
Republican challenger and former Natural Resources Commissioner Dan Sullivan explained he wanted more management decisions made at the state level instead of by federal regulators. Both hit on those respective messages throughout the night. Later, when Sullivan was asked about immigration, he again signaled distrust of Washington. Where Begich called for compromise, Sullivan critically compared immigration reform efforts to health care reform. He said he did not want another case of legislative malpractice like the Affordable Care Act.
I think immigration reform should not be comprehensive. It should be piecemeal.
And on a question about shrinking the size of government, Sullivan said the Consumer Protection Bureau should be nullified because he believes it is unconstitutional. Occasionally, avoidance of some questions created more tension than the direct answers. Sullivan dodged a question from Begich on whether he supported the Patriot Act, an anti-terrorism surveillance law that was expanded while Sullivan worked for the George W. Bush administration, and during a lightning round where candidates were asked to write their answers on a whiteboard, Jeopardy style, Begich refused to say how he voted on the oil tax referendum that narrowly failed last week. Instead, he wrote private. In an interview after the debate, Begich said he didn't think the question was topical.
The public has spoken. It's irrelevant to the issues that we're facing. That issue is not a congressional issue.
Sullivan, who advocated for the new capped tax system while directing the Department of Natural Resources, wrote that he voted to keep that regime. On top of the non-answers, the lightning round resulted in some wrong ones, too. The candidates were asked a number of Alaska trivia questions, like, what's the size of the state relative to Texas? Begich couldn't identify Lake Iliamna as the largest body of freshwater in the state, and Sullivan guessed that the Salty Dog Saloon, a Homer landmark, was in Juneau. United for Liberty took a straw poll after the debate, and results show Begich narrowly edging out a win with 90 votes to Sullivan's 85. About a dozen said there wasn't a clear victor. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a father speaks out against a high school hazing incident targeting his son.
He wanted it to disappear and go away. And just call it the tradition of entering high school.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
Archaeologists have been arguing for decades about how human beings got to the New World, and genetic research released today deepens the mystery. An article published in Science magazine shows that there must have been at least 4 pulses of migration from Siberia through Alaska since the last ice age, and the Yupik and Inupiat people now in Alaska actually replaced an earlier population. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
Basing their work on the largest genetic sampling of bones found in the Arctic yet, a group of Danish researchers say the modern native people of Arctic Canada and Alaska are only related in the very distant past to earlier waves that came across thousands of years ago. In fact, says lead author Mansa Raghavan, the earlier Arctic population, known in Siberia as Sakak and on this side as Paleo-Eskimo and Dorset, was here for thousands of years and was also genetically distinct from earlier migrations that resulted in the Athabaskan and other American Indian populations.
We propose that we remove the Paleo-Eskimos from that particular migration wave and basically grant them a separate migration pulse of their own, which is the Paleo-Eskimos, including the Sakak, or the pre-Dorset culture, and the Dorset culture.
Dr. Eska Willerslev, who heads the genetic lab, is flatly amazed that the people along the Arctic coast and those in the interior of the continent literally had nothing to do with one another, even though their geography overlapped.
That I was actually surprised that we don't find any evidence of a mixture between Native Americans and Paleo-Eskimos. I mean, given that in other studies where when we see people meeting each other, they might be fighting each other, but normally they actually also have sex with each other, and that doesn't really seem to have been the case here.
The picture that emerges is of a people now vanished who developed a stable culture that lived off the lean country of the Arctic for at least 4,000 years. Archaeologist William Fitzhugh of the Smithsonian Institution theorizes that they could only have done that by being very conservative.
When you have people who are so close to nature, as the Paleo-Eskimos had to be to survive, they had to be extremely careful about maintaining good relationships with the animals. And that meant, you know, not, in a sense, polluting your relationship by introducing new ideas, new rituals, new materials, and so forth.
And then, about 700 years ago, a new wave out of Alaska and Siberia, known as the Thule people, simply replaced them. The genetic evidence out today shows there was very little interbreeding, and the Thule people, from whom the modern Inuit population is descended, replaced the conservative Dorset.
Socially and economically, they just were no match for this onslaught from this Thule machine that moved in very quick order.
Fitzhugh says the Thule migration, equipped with sled dogs, bows and arrows, and a near-military whaling discipline, took about 100 years to sweep all across the upper part of the continent. And that was the end of the Dorsets.
They were, in a sense, sitting ducks. And either they were pushed out into the fringes of the Arctic area where they couldn't survive economically, or else they may simply have been annihilated.
It was thought there was a remnant Dorset population in a remote part of Canada, but the genetics now show that not to be the case. They're gone. Fitzhugh says researchers now need to dig more in Alaska and Siberia to puzzle out these migrations. The genetics indicate they're likely to have come from the same area, an environment somewhere in the Russian Far East so severe as to have almost fossilized the culture.
And it may be that this is a continuation of a Siberian Mesolithic, Neolithic tradition, which is just somehow kept on going in the eastern Arctic because of the isolation and the abundance of animals that kept them, without annihilating them through some sort of, huge climatic changes or other things. It's really an amazing story of continuity and survival.
Willerslev says from a scientific point of view, they could really use more archaeological genetic data from lower latitudes, but that can be hard to come by because it's often the wish of modern tribes that ancient remains not be disturbed. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
A Juneau school district investigation finds 7 high school seniors responsible for the paddling of 6 incoming freshmen. The incident took place shortly after school ended in May. At a press conference on Wednesday, the district said the investigation is over and it's not naming any of the students involved or what punishments they could face. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Jim Bradley is the father of one of the victims. He says his son, a basketball player, was hit with a paddle about 7 times and came home with huge welts.
I found out through other people that it happened because he didn't want to have it made anything of, you know. He wanted it to disappear and go away and just call it the tradition of entering high school.
Bradley says the concept of initiation isn't new to him. He went through hazing himself as a student.
When I was initiated, I was, you know, eggs on my head, shaving cream, go swim in the lake or something like that, but never physically or mentally abused like these kids were.
Bradley and his son are dealing with the situation differently. Bradley's son, who he doesn't want to name, didn't participate in the district's investigation. Bradley did. He wants justice for his son.
He's had to deal with it ever since then. He's had to be scared. He's had to walk around the schools and see his friends, and he's had to hide this from his friends and family, you know, the fact that he got hit.
Superintendent Mark Miller says what happened at the end of May, shortly after school ended, is not an isolated case. The investigation found that paddling as a form of initiation has been going on for at least 10 years, other types of initiation for much longer.
Apparently, some of these seniors were actually hazed in a similar manner when they were freshmen. So this is a pattern of recurring violence that we have seen over time. One of the things that actually came out is apparently one of the paddles was passed down from one student to another.
Hazing is considered one of the most severe violations of board policies and school rules. The district's high school discipline plan calls for a minimum penalty of 1 to 10 days of suspension. The maximum penalty is permanent expulsion. All forms of initiation by school or non-school sponsored groups are also prohibited. The 7 seniors involved in the paddling attend various high schools. 4 are athletes, but Miller says the hazing wasn't related to any particular sport. Attorney John Sedor, who was hired by the district for the investigation, went through emails and old postings on social media sites to uncover how the victims were chosen, but Miller says it's still unclear. He says the victims likely weren't surprised that they were picked.
Students generally, I believe, knew something like this was coming because, it's been going on for so long that it's a pattern everybody knew.
When asked if the students were taken against their will, Miller says this.
I don't think anybody wants to be taken out to the woods and paddled, but it was a rather complex social interaction.
Miller says details of the investigation and names of the students are confidential due to student privacy issues and attorney-client privilege. He says the district is addressing the problem through disciplinary action, education, and restorative justice.
We're still exploring exactly what it looks like, but the implementation of an anti-bullying curriculum within advisory is something that we talked about working with our counselors to make sure that the message gets through to everybody. This is not okay. This needs to stop, and everybody knows it needs to stop.
Bradley says he's glad the district is punishing the students who did the paddling and trying to change the culture of hazing. He doesn't want it to happen to next year's incoming freshmen.
And I also want to make sure that my son doesn't feel entitled to do this in 3 more years. I'm not going to allow him to turn around and do this to anybody either.
Since the paddling, Bradley says he's been thinking about it every day. Now that something's being done about it, he hopefully won't have to. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
The NSTAR operating employees strike is over, but the workers do not have a new contract. After 2.5 weeks on strike, they returned to work today. Greg Walker with Local 367 says not all of the employees wanted to return, but he says they didn't want the community to suffer.
There's a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done in the state. I know that the developers, many of the people that are looking for, that have new construction and looking for gas service to be put to those homes, they're way behind schedule.
Walker says the union is trying new tactics to come to a contract agreement with Canadian-owned NSTAR over retirement benefits. John Sims with NSTAR said in a statement that the company accepted the employees' unconditional offer to return to work and all offices are open for regular business. The Southeast Island School District on Prince of Wales Island encompasses 9 small rural schools. Last year, the district implemented a 4-day school week in all but one school. It works so well that every school is running on a Monday through Thursday schedule this year. KRBD's Emily Files has more.
Southeast Island School District schools are tiny. Most have just 2 teachers and between 10 and 20 students spanning grades K through 12. They're separated from each other by miles of land or even by water in Port Alexander's case. With such remote rural schools, you have to be adaptable. Here's Superintendent Lauren Birch.
You know, we're trying to meet the needs of our families. I mean, you can't have a basketball team and a kid with school with 10 kids, but you can have an archery program.
The 4-day school week is just another way the district has adapted to meet the needs of the families. Birch says the idea actually came from parents. They heard about rural school districts in the lower 48 having success with the Monday through Thursday model. There was some hesitation at first, including from Nick Higson. He's principal for all of the Southeast Island schools except Thorne Bay.
We have to sometimes force ourselves to embrace change. You know, because I kind of run with the philosophy, if it's not broken, let's not try to fix it.
But the push to try it grew stronger, and in 2012, Superintendent Birch attempted to get approval from the State Department of Education.
We had many legitimate concerns about our educational program that, you know, we had to satisfy before we moved on. So, but it's just, you know, it's counterintuitive that a four-day school week would be successful.
The idea didn't pan out for the 2012-2013 school year, but for the 13-14 year, the school district submitted a more detailed proposal to the state, and it was approved. The next step was to get approval from the advisory councils at each school, which are made up of mostly parents. The main concern for them? Child care on Fridays. So the district administration decided to organize Friday activities.
We do things like, you know, artists in residence, where we bring in an artist and they come in and do silk screening with our kids on that Friday. Or we do swim lessons with our kids and we take them to the pool and they do swim lessons. We did a number of activities where kids get this really neat enrichment opportunity on Fridays that they wouldn't necessarily get in a block scheduled day.
Some families chose to spend that extra day off with subsistence activities.
You know, people do hunt and gather here a lot. I mean, hunting, fishing, mushrooms, berries. They appreciate that time to get out, you know, and have a 3-day weekend.
The kids, absolutely, not 100% of them, a very, very high number of them absolutely love it. It allows them to spend more time with their families, either doing subsistence activities. It allows them to go to things like the DMV or the dentist or the doctor on a non-school day so they don't miss instructional time. And that's really, really important.
It also cuts down on days students miss to travel for sports. The support for the 4-day week isn't completely unanimous. Principal Higson surveyed students and parents and put their anonymous responses on the school district's website. Most of the feedback is positive, but some kids commented that the teachers give more homework because of the extra day off, or that they feel they learned more in the 5-day week. For Higson, he sees the impact of the 4-day week in the test scores.
And the test data that we got back at the end of the year is phenomenal.
Scores either went up or stayed the same. Nothing went down. And what about the teachers? Here's Superintendent Birch.
The teachers have been, well, I think unanimous and supportive of it. And I wasn't really sure how that would go either, because now they're working harder longer. But on those Fridays, about half of the Fridays are work days. And so, you know, you can do your professional development, you're working together, you grade your papers, and it's created a much, much more collaborative time for teachers to work together.
The four-day school week hasn't saved money for the district. With Friday activities and the slightly longer days Monday through Thursday, Birch says it actually ends up being a bit more expensive. But the shorter week fits with people's lifestyles in these communities, and that is what has made it stick. Reporting from Ketchikan, I'm Emily Files.
It's been one of the rainiest summers on record in Fairbanks, but as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, that hasn't hampered the debut of a new recreation area.
The Fairbanks North Star Borough opened the new Tanana Lakes Recreation Site in June. It offers a swim beach, picnic area, and launches for motorized and paddle boats in lakes along the Tanana River in South Fairbanks. Borough Project Coordinator Steve Taylor says despite this summer's mostly cool, wet weather, the area has been popular.
On the days when the sun is shining, we've had, from just our own expectations, pretty solid use down there.
Taylor cites numerous days when the beach parking lot overflowed. There are no admission or parking fees at Tanana Lakes, and Taylor points to the area's location at the end of a downtown street as another key to its popularity.
So close to town, it's just a quick jaunt for folks to get down there that I think that's really made it appealing, and I think it's just a beautiful area, too. It really has a lot of qualities that can attract people.
Under development since 2008, over $3 million of federal, state, and local funds, plus private grants, have been invested in Tanana Lakes, transforming a part of South Fairbanks that was a common spot for crime and partying.
Not really a place that people would want to just go down with their family and hang out, so we weren't sure how the community was going to embrace it when we opened it up as a park.
Taylor says having staff on site nearly round the clock this summer helped keep the area safe. He says staffing will continue through moose hunting season, during which the area is also expected to get a lot of use. Tanana Lakes is still under development. Taylor says immediate plans call for more basic infrastructure.
Filling in the gaps, making the area more user-friendly, connecting the trails, developing the motorized side of the lake a little bit more for day use. I think camping is something that we're interested in seeing down there. So there's a lot of components and parts and pieces that we need to kind of fill into the park.
Taylor says the borough has received a $62,000 grant for trail work and will pursue money for additional projects. Borough Parks and Recreation Department is holding public meetings to gather input on Tanana Lakes following the rec site's first summer. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Lisa Fu in Juneau, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Emily Files in Ketchikan, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez and Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. ExxonMobil Alaska, where more than 1,000 Alaskan men and women are working on the Point Thompson Project, proving energy lives here. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable contributions. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.